Okay, so I think I'll get started. I'd like to once again thank the conference organizers for providing this wonderful conference in this wonderful location. So today I want to try to talk a little bit about problems related to evolution of genetic networks and what people call the inverse problem in genetic networks. One of the things that continues to amaze me as I sit in seminars in the Department of Physiology is everybody is describing these incredibly elaborate mechanisms for control or for behavior of single proteins, control on a systems level or control on a cellular level and so forth. We've heard examples here from all sorts of different animals, mice, guinea pigs, rabbits, people, dogs, and everybody's heart seems to work pretty well. The systems are incredibly robust, and we know that the information for this is largely contained. What separates the species is the different genomes, and it's an incredible puzzle to me how the networks that are regulating this can evolve. A lot of the talk about evolution and so forth is talking about evolution in with respect to individual molecules, but not with respect to the genetic network. So I think that in the future there's going to be increasing amounts of work concerning evolution in genetic networks. I'm going to finish by sometime between 9:45 and 9:50, so Emilia has some material that she would also, that I was talking to her about the material and it sounded really quite interesting and exciting. So we'll make sure that Emilia has enough time to talk. So this is a differential equation. This is a differential equation that was formulated by Stu Kaufman and myself back in the early 1970s and has been a source of fascination for me ever since then. The variables are xi, and xi is roughly associated with something that a gene is expressing, mRNA or protein. It's easier to think of it as the final product, but it kind of is lumping together a few processes in one variable. And the bi is control of that variable by the other variables in the system. Now, this is meant to represent what the dynamics of a single variable would look like. It may go down and it may go up as a function of time. When it goes down, when it passes some threshold here, which is just taken to be 0.5 but could really be anything, it has a logical variable which is distinguished by a capital X, which is going to be 1, and if it's lower than that threshold, that variable is going to be called 0. So as this evolves in time, it crosses a threshold. There's a logical state associated with that given by the capital X's, and that capital X goes from plus 1 to 0 whenever this crosses its threshold. So that's what the capital XI and the little XI means. Actually, capital XI is just a Heaviside step function on the little XI. And what this is any potential Boolean function of all of the variables of the system. So this is meant to be a vector, which is a Boolean vector of ones and zeros, which tells whether all of those variables are bigger or less than the threshold. And then there's an exponential decay term for each of those variables. So this type of equation is a piecewise linear equation. For any set of the variables, for any point in phase space, all of these variables are, this is either going to be, for each variable, it's going to either be going up exponentially to an asymptote or decaying down exponentially. In the current case, I've taken all parameters equal to 1, but with just a little bit of imagination, you can imagine how I can introduce different time constants and production rates over here, and even lower asymptotes. So this is the least general way of writing the equation, but it's just meant to show you, give you an idea of this equation. So in this talk, there's a reasonable amount of work that's been done in understanding the properties of this equation. For a long time, I was the only one interested in it. More recently, there's been a lot of work done by somebody by the name of Rod Edwards. There's a group in Norway that's done some work. And I'll also point out that it's very, very close, and it's a generalization in some ways of some of the neural net equations in limits where the neural net functions turn into step functions. Also, one can also think about what happens if these Boolean functions are not step functions, but are smoothed out step functions of different sorts. So there's a lot of mathematics that's been done, including some rigorous mathematics, which is possible because the equations are piecewise linear. So for the hardcore nonlinear dynamics people, the equations are piecewise linear. This enables us to explicitly integrate them. We can explicitly follow the flows around from volume to volume. We can explicitly compute what's known as the Poincaré map. And the Poincaré maps for these equations are what's called linear fractional maps. And we can, iteration of two linear fractional maps once again gives a linear fractional map. And this, for the people who are into the nonlinear dynamics, is what enables us to do a lot of analysis with these equations. I'm not going to talk about that analysis in this talk. The rationale for the equation is that a method was needed to relate qualitative properties of networks, connectivity and interactions, for example, to the qualitative properties of the dynamics. These equations allow detailed mathematical analysis. There are a whole bunch of discrete math problems like classification, nonlinear dynamics problems like proofs of limit cycles in chaos and high dimensions. But the idea was the following. This is a graph that's taken from some arbitrary website, Fibrosis Pathway, but literally you can find hundreds of diagrams similar to this all over the biological literature. These are either representing proteins or genes or combinations of proteins and genes, transcription factors. There are arrows between them indicating that there's some sort of interaction. You may or may not be able to see that some of them have plus signs, meaning that they facilitate them. Others have minus signs, meaning that they inhibit them. And the question is, so what? Supposing this was not there, how do we go from something like this to say something about what the functioning of this would actually be if you actually built a system with this connectivity and this interaction? And in fact, that class of equations enables you to investigate those types of problems in a very simple sort of way. Now, evolution of dynamics. So one of the observations you can make with this class of equations is that given some set of Boolean functions, given some connectivity diagram of who touches who and what those functions are for who touches who, and given the restriction that nobody can turn himself on or off, nobody is an input into himself. In other words,
but that's not the correct assumption.
It's not the correct assumption, that's correct. But if something is an input to itself, it's generally not directly, but can be through some intermediate, like an intermediate transcription factor. So it could always move this system up a dimension and include self-input that way. So, but that's correct. But this is a mathematics assumption of the no self-input. In that situation, the dynamics, and in a crude representation of the dynamics, can be given by a directed graph on an n-dimensional hypercube, where each edge in the hypercube is oriented in a single direction. Given that construction, it's possible to count the number of different networks you have under the symmetry group of the n-dimensional hypercube. If there are only two variables, then there are four networks. If there are three variables, there are 112 networks. Four variables, 11 million. And five networks, there are 3 times 10 to the 20th numbers of networks. A lower bound on this number can be derived by taking the total number of networks. You have the total number of directed graphs on the n-dimensional hypercube, which is 2 raised to the number of edges of the hypercube, and dividing it by the number of elements in the symmetry group of the n-dimensional hypercube. And when we get to 5 dimensions, the lower bound is accurate to 7 decimal places. You're still missing trillions and trillions of networks in doing that, but it's a very good estimate. In 2 dimensions, it's obviously not a very good estimate. And in 4 dimensions, it's quite good. So as long as we're in 5 dimensions, we have a huge number of networks, much bigger than could ever be investigated and studied by enumeration. And each of these networks represents a class of networks. Each of these Boolean functions, or directed graphs on a hypercube, those are interchangeable with one another, represent a huge class of networks because we can change around those parameters, the decay constants, production rates, and so forth. Okay, so having spent a lot of time doing mathematical analysis of these equations and being interested in the real world, more, I would say, than the mathematical world, it was interesting to try to think about potential applicability of these things to the real world. I spent a sabbatical with Jim Collins in, 2001, 2002, and during the course of that sabbatical, I had wanted to try to evolve genetic circuits in bacteria, because that was related to what Jim was doing at the time. We couldn't figure out a good way to do that during the time I would be there. But from conversations with a physicist named Paul Lindsay, we learned that we could build electronic circuits that could simulate those equations, and we could try to study evolution in those electronic circuits. So the basic idea is that each one of the genes is represented by an RC circuit, and then there's a combinatorial logic input so that we can represent the 16 possible Boolean function inputs, not Boolean function inputs, Boolean functions that you can have of 4 inputs. I'm not saying this correctly. You could represent all of the possible Boolean functions of those 4 inputs. It's 2 to the 16th possible Boolean functions of those 2 inputs. You could represent all of those, and you could generate them using CMOS logic. So there's a combinatorial element. The truth tables are designated by specifying a set of ones and zeros going into a bunch of AND gates, and by putting an OR function in, you're going to designate if this is on, then the variable is exponentially increasing, and if it's off, and it's exponentially increasing up to 5 volts, and if it's off, it's exponentially decreasing down to zero volts, and the time constant is set by the RC in that particular circuit. So this is a real circuit, and that's what it looks like. This was built by Jonathan Mason, who is a postdoctoral fellow. Each one of these 5 boards represents one of the genes of the system, and that's what one of those particular boards look like. So it turned out that this was much more time-consuming to build and to make sure the connections were tight than we thought it would be. It's possible to do a summary of cycle. So if we're going to evolve this real thing, then the question is, what's the evolution task? I've always been interested in oscillations and stable oscillations, so we decided the evolution task would be to try to evolve it to have a cycle of a certain length. So we do a survey of what's the cycle length that you can get, just looking at random networks in the system. The RC time constant, by the way, is not exactly the same for each of these variables because it comes about as a result of real resistance and capacitance. But it was set, those were chosen to make that time constant approximately equal to 10 milliseconds. And this represents a distribution of the cycle length of about 300 random circuits. By the way, here is a particular a particular cycle. This is the one that shows up. If you build these things randomly, you come up with a particular cycle, time as being the most popular. Does anybody want to guess what that cycle is? No? So that cycle corresponds to the cycle in this, that corresponds to this inhibitory network of three elements where A inhibits B, inhibits C, inhibits A. So if you just build these networks randomly, then that's the most common stable cycle that you get, and that's the circuit that's been the connection matrix that's been made famous by Michael Ellowitz's paper, Michael Ellowitz and colleagues' paper about the repressolator.
Yeah, why do they use electronics, not the computer?
What?
Why do they use electronics?
Why did we use the electronics rather than the computer?
Yeah.
So everybody asked that question. So the question is correct. So in fact, I started doing all of this without electronics. I did many of these things with the computer. The thing is that the computer is a computer and the electronics is a real thing. Okay? So this is a real system. The real system has all sorts of things associated with real systems, like time delays, different time constants. It has problems associated with sampling time. In fact, it could have all been done digitally, and much of it has been done digitally. But it's a difference between looking at something that's the real world as opposed to looking at a mathematical model of the real world. This is an electronic model of a mathematical model instead of the opposite.
Not convincing at all.
This is a mathematician's perspective. So this is examples of different periodicities, and this is an example of an evolutionary run. So the task we made up for this was to evolve a cycle that was a cycle that would be very rarely seen in the system just spontaneously. So in this particular context, cycles of length 80 milliseconds is a cycle which would be almost never seen.
So
yeah?
You start with various initial conditions and just see before.
Just take one arbitrary initial condition. This is just done starting with an arbitrary initial condition. You turn on the lab view board and it starts off and you see what it ends up in. So it's not, we haven't done a careful study of bistability or multistability in these systems.
Yeah.
Yes?
Sorry, let me back up couple slides in the previous slide. I'm still a little lost. So what are the parameters that actually control, distinguish between your 2 to the 16 possible functions?
Okay, so
what is being evolved?
Okay, okay, so I didn't say that very carefully. So there are 16 betas. Okay, if I have four variables, the truth table of Boolean function truth table of four variables, there are 16 ones and zeros. Those are generated for each one of these variables by specifying a 16 betas as one or zero. Each one of these AND gates, there are 16 AND gates, and each one of them is fed in with a beta, which is one or zero. And it's ANDed to all of the possible different combinations of the four variables corresponding to the four states.
So what is the meaning of the beta?
The beta is just the... So
we just...
Okay. If we just... if we just have four variables, we have x1, x2, x3, x4. And when you do the truth table, you can have all of the possible states of these. And then in the truth table for this, we have some sequence of ones and zeros, which is the truth table for that particular variable. So what we're essentially doing is building a circuit which can embody the values of the betas in the truth table. And if you have a 1 for some particular state here, and if the network is in that state, then you're going to be going high and going up to plus 5 volts. If it's zero, you're going to be going down to 0 volts. What we're evolving is we take a certain evolution rate, for example, 2%, and then we randomly for each one of these truth tables, we randomly choose the digits in this truth table. 2% of the time, we say whatever is there, we randomly choose a 1 or a 0. Okay, if it's 5%, we see whatever is there in approximate. Right, we choose a random number saying whether it's going to evolve or not, and then we randomly select something to be a 1 or a 0. Is that making it more clear? Okay. Okay, so this is just an example. You can see that and then if you have something which is closer to the target period, then you keep with that. Then you keep with that particular oscillation, and then you do the evolution from that new set of truth tables rather than the old one. So you can see how many generations you can go with different networks. You end up and you evolve eventually to some system which has a cycle length which is within the target of your cycle length, and it takes a certain length of time in which to do that. So one of the things we're interested in, and I think I'm going to push through this very quickly because I wanted to tell you a couple of additional topics, you can see what the optimal mutation rate, the optimal rate is to modify those parameters in the truth table, and it's possible to make estimates of what that should be by studying what's known as the fitness landscape of the system. So in some sense, the phase space of these networks are the truth tables, the 2 to the 80th different truth tables that you can have representing the 2 to the 80th different networks, and each one of those different networks has a different fitness under this. It's completely unfit if it doesn't have a stable cycle, and then the fitness gets better as the cycle gets closer to this particular target cycle length. So this is just kind of a pointer to this work, and you can find that the paper was published in Chaos in 2004. The first author was Jonathan Mason. Okay, so then I wanted to say a little bit about the inverse problem, and the inverse problem is generally, supposing you know the dynamics in a network, supposing you're given the dynamics in a network, what is the underlying network that's generating those dynamics? Now, in general, that's a difficult problem. What I'm going to talk about is research that's in particular been mostly done by Ted Perkins, who was a postdoctoral fellow and is now a faculty member at McGill. He was a postdoctoral fellow with me. So somebody mentioned earlier the types of problems that arise here. This is now expression data from early development in Drosophila, where these different bands represent different proteins that are produced in this beautiful banded patterns at early stages of development. I learned about this, and these slides are slides that are taken from John Reinitz. John Reinitz, I heard John talk about some of this maybe 5 or 8 years ago or something, and he's doing beautiful work both in terms of collecting data and then also trying to figure out what the underlying networks are. So in general, people can measure gene expression now in a variety of different ways. This method is by using fluorescent antibodies and then trying to do very careful timing studies and staging studies. So if gene expression changes over time, the general problem is, given time series expression data, learn the dynamical model of gene expression, explain expression in terms of regulatory relationships between genes, which genes regulate which, and how do regulatory influences combine to determine gene activity. Okay, so we can go ahead. So one problem that was done was to take very big networks of, so this is going back to digital, so you'll be happy, Arkady, this is a digital. So you can generate these networks digitally, and you can see what the time is. So this is an example of time series from a network of 100 of those model genes, in which each one of those genes had random inputs from 10 other genes in the system. And this is an example of what the time series looked like for 10 of those genes. And we say, what is the underlying network that's generating that? And more than that, we say, can we learn anything about the process? So just reminding you that this is the equation that we're examining. We're looking at dynamics in this particular equation. And in this particular equation, just because we know so much about that particular equation, it's actually possible to make, it's possible to do a computation that can estimate the amount of data that you need in order to do the inverse problem. So if you inverse problem wants to just say who touches who, which gene influences which other gene, then, for example, if you have 300, 3,000, or 30,000 genes, 10 inputs per gene, let's just look at 3,000. If you have 10 inputs per gene, then you need of the order of 10 to the fifth different transitions, meaning changes of state, in order to, changes of state correspond to changes in the slope, in the first derivative of one of the variables. You need of the order of 10 to the fifth different changes in order to see who is touching whom. And if you wanted to know exactly what the function is, if you go for the same characteristics, 3,000 model genes, 10 inputs per model gene, then you need of the order of 10 to the 7th transitions in order to do that problem. And in fact, it's possible to do the inverse problem for these particular equations on, it's possible to figure out what the underlying networks and interactions are for these equations. It's also possible, supposing you're only presented with information from partial numbers of these elements, it's possible to estimate what fraction of the network you actually know something about for these particular equations. It's also possible to do a variety of different things like add noise and so forth. Many of those have not been done yet, but it's possible. You can also generate, here's going back to the real system, you can generate an electronic circuit that generates a very irregular rhythm, which we believe is a chaotic rhythm in this case. In other cases, one can come close to proving it. So here's an example of the dynamics you get from an electronic network. This is now a real system. There's noise involved. There's time scales and so forth. And it's possible to figure out the truth tables from a short sequence of about several seconds worth of data. It's possible to do the inverse problem and figure out most of the elements in the truth table, and it's also possible to figure out the threshold constants and the upper and lower asymptotes and the time constants for this particular real network using these procedures. So I just want to mention two more problems that we've looked at. One of the problems was to try to extend similar methods looking at the gene expression data of genes that's collected by John Reinitz. This is gene expression data from several of the genes involved in early Drosophila development. John Reinitz's data and Ted Perkins. John Reinitz has done, going back to the mid-1990s, has developed methods to do the inverse problem on these networks. The inverse problem uses what's called simulated annealing, and these are extremely time-demanding processes from a computational point of view. And then one of the things that Ted Perkins did was develop much, much more efficient methods that chop several orders of magnitude to try to come up with good representations of good representations of the data. So you can essentially get analytic quantitative agreement with the expression data from many genes. The paper describing this was in PLS Computation Biology in 2006. So the main conclusions of this are that there are the model differential equations and electronic models. These networks can evolve, and it is possible to determine the networks based on observed dynamics in model equations and in electronic circuits in the Drosophila. But there are problems for real complex physiological data. Real data has noise, biological variability, very few time points, great expense, time delays, and the question of what are the networks underlying real physiological data in more complicated systems than the Drosophila development are truly very formidable at the moment. So we're interested in problems associated with heart, and I would just like to share with you, just to finish up, experimental data and a little bit of analysis of gene expression in dogs who have rapid pacing of the atrial ventricles. So this is an experiment which is really, it's a system that's really spearheaded by Stan Nattel, who many of the people here know. So this is really an experiment and work that's done in his laboratory, and Sophie Cardin and Patricia Pelletier are graduate students in the laboratory, and then some of the data analysis was done by Eric Libby, who's a very talented graduate student who's working with me at McGill. So are people familiar? Nobody has mentioned these chips in this experiment. People familiar with these methods? So it's possible to take these gene expression chips and to analyze the abundance of thousands of different types of mRNA from tissues in animals. And you can determine the abundance of these amounts of mRNA simultaneously. One of the problems in terms of the early work in genetic networks is that there was no data. It was very hard to get data. Now there is beginning to be the possibility of huge amounts of data. The principle behind this is that there are probes on the chip, and mRNA anneals to the probes on the chip. They're fluorescently labeled, and as a consequence of the fluorescent labels, the raw data looks like this, in which the bright spots represent places where the mRNA from the sample that you're studying attaches and hooks on to the probe in the on that little chip. The chips are about this big, just a couple of centimeters big. So it's nanotechnology. Stan Nattel has looked at models of atrial fibrillation. This is a ventricular tachypacing model of atrial fibrillation in which the ventricles are paced very rapidly. The animals develop atrial fibrillation, and that's associated in this animal model with a large amount of fibrosis in the atria as a consequence of the rapid atrial pacing. The atria no longer can pump blood effectively, they become distended, and the body has reactions which lead to fibrosis of the atria. Doing experiments like this is unbelievably time-consuming and expensive. There were multiple dogs in several different groups. There are some groups, and these are models for atrial fibrillation that has been studied by Stan Nattel and others over the past several years. So if you rapidly pace the atria continuously, you can generate atrial fibrillation. And similarly, if you rapidly pace the ventricles continuously, you can also generate atrial fibrillation. But these don't develop immediately. They develop over a period of time, and this is associated with remodeling of the atria and changes of the atria. So there are protocols in which several animals in each group are having the same manipulations done. The cardiac tissue from each of these animals are then analyzed and pooled, and there are several replicates of the data, and there also have to be shams and so forth. Each one of the chips that's analyzed is approximately $1,000. So these types of experiments cost tens of thousands of dollars and multiple dog lives. I think that I just want to try to tell you. So I'll just try to tell you what the main points of the findings are. So the main points of the finding is that the rapid atrial pacing leads to much smaller changes in the mRNA expression than the ventricular tachypacing, according to the analysis that's been done. It's possible to look at different classes of RNA associated with different cellular processes, and to try to see which classes of cellular processes are over or underexpressed, and it can be at one time point, at the other time point, or at both time points. And it's possible to try to get. So what happens out of the 25,000 or 22,000 genes, it turns out that of the order of 2,500 of them seem to be differentially expressed under the ventricular tachypacing conditions, and it's possible to get some image. So if you go through all of the genes that are differentially expressed and you try to look and see what the percentage, these are like cumulative probability functions of how many genes that are differentially expressed in the extracellular matrix group are expressed by the time you get to 1,000 out of the 2,500 genes. So the fact that this line in this representation is very high seems to indicate that the extracellular matrix genes are especially differentially expressed in these particular systems.
So then what do you do with that information?
Well, so one of the things, so I think that one of the big problems is how do you make sense of all of this? So we go from the very easy things to make sense of and understand to this kind of stuff, which is harder to make sense of and understand. So one of the ways you can try to make sense of and understand it is you can try to then go back and do bioinformatics analysis. So one of the things that Eric Libby did was he went and he then tried. So in terms of the extracellular matrix analysis, one of the key factors is what's called TGF-beta. And he tried to look in databases and see all of the genes that are hooked up with TGF-beta in database analyses. He then tried to come up just using bioinformatics tools, not looking at this data initially, to come up with all of the genes that are associated with either TGF-beta or all of the genes associated with everything associated with TGF-beta, and then to see which of those are differentially expressed in the current data set. And he came up with this bunch of different genes, and one of the things in here is called connective tissue growth factor, which seems to be playing a very central role and is also differentially expressed at both of the time points. And the proposal, it's possible to come up with the proposal that this may be important in playing a role in the control of the fibrosis. So this is a very speculative thing to come up with, but it answers exactly your question of what can you possibly do with
this. Does this diagram indicate that connective growth factor, whatever, is central player?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, So how do you know? How do you know?
Then you'd have to do more experiments.
No, but I mean, how does the informatics suggest that that's the central player?
Okay, it had a lot of connectivity. It's also a growth factor. Fibronectin is a structural molecule. So the fact that this seems to be a transcriptional growth controller seemed to indicate that this may be playing.
The transcriptional regulation.
Yeah, right. And it was also highly expressed at an early stage.
Cannot this conclusion just be drawn from histologies that will know that the connective tissue is...
From the histology, Well, you can say that, but from the histology, you know the histology.
And then it goes directly to bioinformatics trying to...
The histology tells you the histology. It doesn't tell you about the gene control. You might say the histology is different because there are genes that have been activated, some have been activated, some have not been activated. You might feel that doing this analysis is not worth $40,000 and 3 man-years of work or something of that sort. But
the brute force approach.
It's a brute force approach. It's also providing enormous amounts of very low quality data. Okay? We haven't gone into details of the data. But in fact, in my opinion, this is in some organisms that are easier to control, like yeast and so forth, which are, you know, I think that people are probably making more progress than this in terms of identifying and understanding what's happening. This is the first controlled study of gene expression over time in animal models of atrial fibrillation. Okay? And it's at the moment it hasn't been accepted. Okay?
So when you come up with a model like this here, you also come up with a minimum error?
This is just an association matrix.
But the function will determine whether.
Right. So like I show this to show the difference between, you know, where we are in this as compared to where you would really want to be. So in this, we don't know we don't have anything on the arrows. Absolutely.
Yeah, we don't know the function.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
What happens for the ionic channels?
So the ionic channels are hard at... I can't tell you exactly. I don't know... The ionic channels are not as well represented on the chip as one would like them to be. And there's not particularly remarkable changes in differential expression of that in the context of doing this experiment. And other experiments by other people that are more specifically oriented towards looking at ionic channels, there have been some differences found. And Penny Boyden, for example, is one of the people.
And can you identify the main pathway which leads to this change?
In my opinion, at the moment, those are things people would like to do but haven't done. So could I just say that I would... Could we break off this discussion to give Amelia a chance to come and say something? Yeah, well...
Related to the components that we talked about before, the inverse problem.
Sure.
I may have missed this, you probably see this, but... So when you have model-generated dynamics, and then from this you want to do an inverse problem to understand a network, a unique network, or it's many different networks?
Okay, so the thing is that in the model system, when we're doing things with the Boolean networks, then the material done in the analysis of the Boolean networks is a unique system generating that particular network. In terms of the gene expression and the inverse problem in Drosophila, one of the points of the article is that there can be other networks that can give good agreement with the data that's available based simply on the gene expression data, but then there is a whole bunch of other types of experiments, knockout experiments and so forth, that the data also has to be considered.